State ascoltando SBS Italian.
I thought I wouldn't be able to have my own child, so having one to me just felt like an absolute miracle. And in that moment, I couldn't understand why a mother would give up her child, because I was ignorant about the circumstances.
You're listening to an SBS Italian podcast. My name is Magica Fossati, and today we have the honor of hosting Cynthia Benham, author, writer, and specifically the author of the book Mother Shadow, A Meditation on Maternal Inheritance, the book we're going to be talking about today. Cynthia, welcome to SBS. Benvenuta.
Thank you, Magica. It's wonderful to be here.
Name and surname, don't give it away straight away, but you do have an Italian background, don't you?
And I often wish my mother had given me the name Cinzia. I thought it's a name. But anyway, Cynthia is what I have. Yes, my mother came to Australia from Trieste in about 1957 when she was 9 years old, along with her sister and my grandparents. Yeah.
So you grew up in touch with your Italian background because you had your grandparents nearby, is that right?
That's right. We would see them every Saturday for lunch at their house in southwest Sydney in Campsie. They only really spoke to us in Italian, and we would eat spaghetti and eat the prosciutto, and we would play the cards. And that was our childhood, was very much connected to our Italian side.
Would you say that that background in a way predisposed you towards becoming the journalist that you then became, an international journalist who traveled a lot around the world? Were you curious as a child of other cultures?
Oh, absolutely. I would say I was the eldest grandchild. And when I was 19, my grandparents, I'd never been to Italy before. It was, you know, my family couldn't afford that, but they really wanted me to go. And they helped me to go to Trieste with a group of it was the Giuliani nel Mondo that used to sort of send back, might still do, the children of immigrants to get to know where they're from in Italy. And so my grandparents really wanted me to do that. And even though I'd been learning Italian at school up until then, it was just so life-changing to actually go and be in the place where my mother was born and my grandparents lived. And it really was life-changing for me. It sort of opened up my deep interest in all things Italian at a much deeper level, and also, as you say, in the world. And yes, I think that probably did spark my interest in international affairs and international journalism.
This is your second memoir, Mother Shadow, and it tells a story that is very close to your heart and that takes you back a few generations. It all starts with the discovery. What was it?
So this second book deals with my mother's maternal side, which I hadn't really explored before, because my nonna's mother, I was always told, I never met her, Nonna Lina, was an orphan from Bologna, not from Trieste. And because I was told she was always an orphan, I always thought that side of our family was closed to me, that I would never be able to find anything more. So Nonna Lina had three daughters. My nonna was the eldest. When the youngest daughter passed away, so all three of that generation had died, my mum, at my request, brought me some of the family documents that would have been, you know, probably thrown away because nobody else in my family was really interested. And I do have this deep abiding interest in my Italian heritage. And among the documents, I found this extraordinary paper, which I never expected to find. It was a birth record, and it had the bottom corner torn off, and it contained the word that I didn't know and my mother didn't know, Brefotrofio. And when I looked it up to see what it meant, it was a foundling home where illegitimate babies, unwed mothers were taken. And this was in the late 19th century. And in that moment, a whole new side of our family and story opened up, because I realized that her parents weren't dead as I'd thought, that she did have a mother. A mother who was compelled for some unknown reason to give her up to a foundling home.
How did that hit you? Did it trigger some sort of strong emotional reaction, this discovery? Because you said you thought she'd been unlucky and lost her parents, maybe to illness or to some other events. But this idea that she'd been intentionally left, what did that trigger in you?
It triggered a very surprising response that now when I look back, I'm quite embarrassed about, because in that moment, all I could think was she had abandoned her baby. She had cut off all her descendants' knowledge of themselves from that point. And I just thought about this little girl who was left without a mother and how terrible it would have been to grow up without the love of a mother. And in that moment, I guess I didn't think of what circumstances would have led the mother to feel that she had to give up her child. Thinking about it later, like, why was my response like this? Why was it so strong? I linked it back to my own experiences. Having a child was like a miracle for me, to have my son, because of things that had happened to me in my career as a journalist, traumas that I'd survived that I thought I wouldn't be able to have my own child. So having one to me just felt like the absolute, like an absolute miracle. And in that moment, I couldn't understand why a mother would give up her child, because I was ignorant about the circumstances.
I guess it's the struggle to put yourself in someone else's shoes after you strove to have a child for so long. It was really unthinkable that someone else would so casually leave their own child to someone else and to an institute called Brefo Trofio, as you were saying. If it's okay with you, you mentioned that you had to face some very strong trauma before you became a mother. As an international journalist, you were traveling a lot and you were unfortunately part of a very tragic plane accident. How did that impact your life?
Yes, it happened when I was 34 years old in 2007. And I was traveling with the foreign minister, Australia's foreign minister, to Indonesia. And the plane I was on crashed in Yogyakarta. And I survived, but many of my colleagues didn't. It upended my life. They didn't think I was going to survive. I got a terrible infection in my legs from the burns. The doctors, to save my life, had to amputate my legs. So suddenly everything that I'd known about my life as a journalist, traveling, I was a runner, I was a marathon runner, everything in that moment was gone. But the one thing for which I was deeply grateful and always be so grateful for is that alongside the love of my family, I had the love of a partner who is now my husband. And one of the first questions I asked my doctor when I came out of a coma, which I was in for a week, was, will I be able to have children? And my burn surgeon said she didn't see why not. And then for me and my partner, Michael, that gave me the hope to keep going. His love kept me going, and the thought that one day we would have a family of our own kept me going and helped me to deal with some of the terrible losses that I suffered.
We're talking to Cynthia Banham about her recent book, Mother Shadow, A Meditation on Maternal Inheritance. You were saying before that you found out this piece of information about your great-grandmother, Nonna Lina, which really struck you as kind of unfair in a way. What did you do? When did you decide to actually go to Italy to find out more about her?
So the first thing I did was I found a researcher in Bologna to help me begin the process of trying to uncover the story of why Natalina was abandoned. I was very fortunate that a friend and an Italian teacher who'd come out from Torino to Canberra, where I was living at the time, to teach at the ANU, had a daughter who was very, very fortuitously now studying at the University of Bologna. So I emailed Milena And she agreed to help me with my project. And she went into the Sala Borsa library in Bologna and into all the different archives in Bologna to try and find out what she could. And straight away, she came back with incredible information. The foundling home's documents had all been preserved at the provincial archives in Bologna, and she was able to get copies of some of the documents and send them to me. And through this, I was able to find out incredible detail about Nonna Lina's life, including the wet nurse, who she was sent to in the country when she was a baby, first abandoned, the foster parents in the mountains outside Bologna who she was sent to, who brought her up, even incredibly the illnesses and diseases she had as a child. And then one of the most startling things of all was that I found in these papers the letters that Natalina wrote when she was in her early 20s. And by then she was living in Trieste and she had to get her dowry, and baby girls left at the foundling home were all guaranteed a dowry to, you know, increase their chances that they would get married one day and have a family of their own. And I found the letters that she actually wrote to the foundling home requesting her dowry when she got engaged. But what was not in there, because it was never recorded, was the name of her mother. There was a law which still applies that when a mother abandons her child, the name is kept secret from the child for 100 years. And back in 1898, it's different now, but back then it was not recorded anywhere by the founding home. So if I was going to find that name, it was not going to be in those archives.
This is an amazing story. It sounds more and more like a detective story. Was your family kind of involved in this search that you started to find out more about the history of your Nonna Lina?
So my mother was very helpful to me in, first of all, in finding those birth documents, bringing them back for me and helping me translate them all. And, you know, I would ask her over and over again for any memories that she had about Nonna Lina, but, you know, there weren't many. Mum left when she was 9 years old, and I think Natalina had died shortly before my grandparents left Trieste for Australia. So there were not many memories there. Mum was helpful, but I don't think anybody, honestly, in my family ever really was propelled by the same kind of obsession and desire that I was to get to the bottom of this story. And at times it was, you know, it was definitely difficult for members of my family to know that I was pursuing the story and coming up with some, you know, some findings that were disturbing at times. You know, it was among them, you know, I think it was probably quite upsetting to know that her beloved Nonna Lina, who really was loved by her daughters and grandchildren so much, that she'd had such a difficult life, that she'd grown up, you know, without her mother. And I think these things were really hard to hear.
Can you mention a pivotal moment in your research to find out about Nonna Lina's mother? Was there something that really triggered a strong reaction from you in what you found out?
There was. We were in Bologna, and it was the day that we went to actually visit the archives where the foundling home documents were kept. And in my reading, I had read that quite often mothers, when they were abandoning their children or relinquishing them to the foundling home, would leave a token hidden in the baby's swaddling, and it would be a medallion, that quite often a medallion that they'd broken in half, and they would leave half with the child and the other half they would keep, hoping that one day if their circumstances changed and they were able to go back and reclaim the child, that the two halves could be matched up and it would be proof of their identity. So after we had read all the files in the archivist's office, I asked if I could, you know, please see these medallions. And the archivist said sure, and got out a big key, and there was this cupboard pushed up against the wall in their room. It was sort of the most interesting bit of furniture in the room, which was pretty bland. Everything was just, you know, white laminated tables and grey chairs. And then there was this old cupboard. And as we went over to it, the archivist said that everything had been maintained intact in this cupboard, which had been brought over from the foundling home to the office when the foundling home closed. And she opened up this cupboard, and it was the most emotional experience to see this whole wall of these half medallions. They were organized each, there were sort of a stack of them on these pins to mark the year that the child had been abandoned. And the cupboard was just absolutely full of, like, must have been like 1,000 half medallions. And not only medallions, but there were playing cards and there were pieces of ribbon. And, you know, there were just all these different little tokens that obviously meant something to the mother. And it was really in that moment that I understood the grief of the mothers who had to leave their children behind. It was a profoundly eye-opening experience for me to understand that, you know, these mothers didn't want to leave their babies behind. They had no choice, and they kept the hope in their heart that one day they would go back for the child. But the fact is that these medallions were all proof of all the babies who were never reclaimed. And indeed, the archivist told me that it was quite rare for mothers to be able to go back.
Of course, the historical setting in which all this happened was very different. So I guess you find out during your research a lot more about what was going on at the time, which would have been also confronting in a way. But at the same time, as the title suggests, this is a process that became also a meditation for you on what it is to be a mum. By that time, you were already a mum. How old was your child when you decided to go to Bologna to work more on this search?
Yeah, so he was 5 years old when I started researching and 6 years old when we finally went to Bologna. And yeah, by that time, I had discovered more, as you say, about the historical context. And I knew that the history of Bologna as a former papal state and the importance of the Catholic Church and Catholic morality in Italy. I've grown up as a Catholic, so I do understand it was very strong, and there was a lot of pressure on women who were not married to give up their children to foundling homes, and it was a real source of shame to be an unwed mother. And indeed, the stigma of being an illegitimate child also carried with the child. So in addition to that, there were, you know, the reasons that women, you know, became pregnant in the first place were sometimes also quite traumatic. They were often, you know, I discovered that Natalina's mother was very poor, and, you know, she worked as a domestic in a wealthier person's house. And often these women were taken advantage of, and the responsibility for the pregnancy always fell with the woman and never the man. So it was a very unequal society, and that combination of sort of poverty and vulnerability, as well as some much more sort of disturbing things that I would discover once we got to Bologna, helped me to understand that Natalina's mother had done the best that she could. She'd given up the child because she thought that that was the way to give her daughter a future and to keep her safe. And I started drawing a parallel. I could see the parallel with my own self as a mother, because bringing up a child, I was using a wheelchair, I wear prosthetic legs. I could never be the mother that I wanted to be for my son. And as much as I wanted him and loved him, I felt a terrible sense of inadequacy, particularly when he was very young, that there were so many things that my mother had done for me that I couldn't do for him. And I was constantly questioning whether this was unfair on my son, that I so desperately wanted a son but couldn't do the things for him that I wanted to. From the earliest days when we brought him home for the hospital, and I couldn't walk him to sleep at night, and I had to hand him over to his grandparents to rock him to sleep and to walk him to sleep. And the feeling of handing my newborn baby over was, you know, it was quite sort of terrible in that moment. And those feelings sort of continued when I couldn't take him at 6 months old to the swimming lessons that his dad took him to because I couldn't get in the pool with him. There was just a whole host of ways that I couldn't be the mother I wanted.
You use the word inadequacy, which I think will probably resonate with a lot of women out there, a lot of mothers, because in one way or another, I think most of us at some stage hit that feeling of inadequacy, of not being really the mother we maybe dreamt to be, even without realizing. We all have some imprinted image of what a mother should be like.
That's so true.
Has that changed for you as you were researching this book? Have you found
Absolutely.
A new way of being a mom, in a way?
Absolutely. Oh, it definitely did. I mean, I can give a couple of examples. Very early on, one of the things that I knew I could do with my child was to read with him. And, you know, he's 14 now and he knows that I'm a writer and he's very proud of his mum for being a writer. And we still read every single night together before he goes to sleep. And this was one way that I could express my love for my son. But another way that was quite particular to the time that we spent in Bologna was we had a wonderful Italian teacher, Valentina, while we were there. She used to come to the apartment that we stayed in and she taught my son and she taught me. And she could see that for a little six-year-old, it was pretty, he'd been removed from, you know, his friends and his school back in Australia. It was pretty dreary and exhausting for him to be carted around to all these libraries and churches and archives. And she suggested that we might like to buy him a scooter. One of the incredible things about spending all this time in Bologna was that, you know, being in a wheelchair in a medieval town on cobblestone streets can be very challenging, to say the least. But because Bologna has these unbelievably beautiful porticos, tens of thousands of kilometres of porticos, it's actually quite a smooth ride for somebody in a wheelchair along the smooth stone. And so when we decided to buy my son the scooter, he was able to ride with me. And we would have this sort of daily pastime of I'd do some research in the morning and then at lunchtime we would go off to the park, Giardini Margherita, just outside the gates of the old medieval gates. And he would have a wonderful time and meet friends in the park. And then we would ride together back to the apartment for our Italian lesson. And so, you know, this was something that no other mother, a mother who wasn't in a wheelchair, could never do with their young son. And so it's just one example of how I found a way to express my love in a way that was very unique to our circumstances and our relationship.
That's beautiful. And it really sums up, in a way, one of the fantastic discoveries that I guess you found along the way and that kind of helped you. And I found a mention of something you said in, I think, one of the book launches you've already had, in which you talked about the experience of writing as really transformational. This is the second time you write a memoir. Does it really help you make sense of your own life and of what has happened to you?
Oh, absolutely, it does. I always say that I am a very different person when I begin to write a book than I am at the end. And some of the feelings, for example, that I express at the start of Mother Shadow, where I have this five-year-old and I'm feeling this sort of terrible inadequacy and I'm judging myself and then I judge Natalina's mother. You know, I now look back at that and just think how much my thinking has changed, that I realize that, you know, what matters is that I've done the best that I possibly could for my child, like she did, and that he loved me for who I am. He doesn't see the wheelchair as the impediment that I see it as, stopping me from being the mother I want. He just sees that as being who his mother is, and that it does have these you know, these things that are special. He once asked me, "Mum, what is it you like about being in a wheelchair?" And I couldn't believe the question. I was like, why would I like anything about being in a wheelchair? And then I remembered that from the time he could first sit up as a baby, he would sit in my wheelchair between my thighs, and we would travel around the house. Or if we were out, my husband was pushing me in a wheelchair, we would travel that way together. We actually didn't need a stroller for him. And that this gave us this incredible closeness that he was quite unwilling to let go of. When we got him the scooter when he was six, he was still asking if he could sit with me on the wheelchair. And I was just like, I thought, you know, maybe the wheelchair was going to break because we were now too heavy, and that's why the scooter was such a good idea. But he doesn't see my injuries and disabilities as a negative. And so I think what I also learned is that in comparing my own experience of mothering to the mothering of Natalina, and we did find the name of her mother, her name was Ursilia, that women are so hard on themselves and often on others in terms of how they mother or the mothers that they are. And we are indeed very harsh on our own mothers quite often. And it showed me how sort of negative and destructive that can be, and that, you know, compassion and forgiveness are really what is needed and what I needed in my life. I needed it towards myself as a mother, because otherwise it, you know, it was sort of blinding me to the fact that it actually didn't matter that my son just loved me for who I was and the mother that I was.
Cynthia, that's such a beautiful way of summing up, in a way, what your book is about. But there's a lot more to discover, of course. We haven't told the whole story, which, as we were saying before, it's a bit like a detective story in some ways, and it's fascinating. You have written two memoirs. The previous one also delved into the history of your grandfather. It's called A Certain Light. It's a genre that, of course, involves the author, but a lot of the family as well. How do you see your responsibility towards the other people involved in your writing? Because, of course, you have to expose part of their lives as well.
Oh, they're very complex moral questions, and the balancing of the different duties one feels is very different. So in writing a book like that, I feel a duty to my readers to tell the most truthful story that I can. I feel a very strong duty to the people who are in the book, who are both alive and deceased, because I know there are things that I'm talking about that they never, ever would have imagined would have been made public, and their own stories. And then there is the duty to myself, because, you know, these stories, even if they didn't happen to me, they tell me who I am today and how I was made and why I am the way I am. And it's only through researching and really doing that deep thinking about these stories, which I do through writing, that I'm really able to kind of come to a better understanding of myself and my life. You know, why has my life turned out the way that it has? Why did these difficult things have to happen to me? To have really bad trauma happen to you can be a deeply isolating experience, because you can feel like you were singled out for something that nobody else was. And that's definitely how I felt after the accident. But through exploring the very difficult stories of my family, I have definitely come to feel less alone in my own struggles and challenges, because I can see that there are different challenges there across all the generations. And, you know, in the first book, I was really interested in my grandfather's World War II experiences. And in this book, it was really about the experiences of, you know, firstly being the feeling, but then more and more became the experience of being a mother who couldn't keep her child. And I was able to put my own experiences, I guess, in context, in a history where really it's a history of survival. It's a history of keeping going. It's a history of doing the best you can for you and your family. And it did make me feel less, it has made me feel less alone.
The book by Cynthia Benham has already been published. It's called Mother Shadow, A Meditation on Maternal Inheritance. And I think you've got a website as well.
Yes, it's just my name, cynthiabenham.com. It's as easy as that.
Thank you so much, Cynthia. Grazie davvero.
Thank you, Magica. It's been lovely talking to you.
Volete ascoltare altre storie come questa? Potete trovarle su Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify o ovunque scarichiate i vostri podcast.